All right. Welcome back, everybody, to the Quilling Query Podcast. My name is Brandon Hall. And as always, I'm joined by my wonderful co-host, Ash. Ash, how are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good. Busy day, but ready to get into it.
Same. Well, it appears we have another special guest with us today. So, Ben, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself and let the audience know who we are talking to today?
All right. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it. I'm Ben Shankman. I am an urban fantasy author, as well as an audiobook narrator and producer.
Awesome. Well, it's great to have you here, Ben. As our second author interview on Quilling Query, we've got some fun questions and topics to go over today. But first, we always like to give a little update on what we're currently reading to the audience. So, Ash, I'll let you go first with your reading update if you want. Looks like you got some interesting ones there.
I do. I've got, I don't know if I removed the old stuff, but my current read that I started last week and I'm obsessed with is Babel by R.F. Kuang. I know I'm late to the game. I love her, but it's dark academia. It's wintertime. I thought, why not? And it's currently fantastic. Also, still slowly working my way through the beta reading for the Blades for Hire anthology. So slow and steady. What about you, Ben? What are you reading?
So I have to admit, I consume a lot of my books through audiobooks because I have a lot going on. So driving my son back and forth from school and all that. So I'm currently finishing up Death Tax by another indie, Andrew Givler. So he's another urban fantasy author that I connected with a while back. It was actually recommended to me on Reddit. So I'm finishing up that. That's the fourth book in his series, and it's narrated by a really good audiobook narrator, Michael Mola.
Very cool. Awesome. Yeah, I consume a lot of books through audio these days too. Not recently, because most of my reading has been the Blades for Hire betas, but outside of that, I usually do have an audiobook or a podcast going during work, so it helps me get through the day. Okay, moving on, we have no podcast updates today other than the one I share every week, which is our guest form is live in the link tree. So if you, like Ben, want to be a guest on Quilling Query, all you have to do is go to the link tree, fill out the form, and we will get back to you. No audience questions this week, but we do have one indie release to spotlight. That is going to be Say Luna's Curse by Maddie Baggins. And that is actually out today as an ebook and will be out in a week on the 19th in print, if you prefer to read it that way. But congratulations, Maddie, on the new release. Looking forward to seeing more from you. And with that, Ben, we move into the next check-in for Quilling Query. This is the work in progress check-in. So it's a little bit of a writing update for our followers. Feel free to join in, or if you don't have any updates to give, it's not required. But Ash, I'll let you go first again, since I've been rambling a little bit. Have you done any writing these past few weeks, or are you kind of taking a well-earned break after pumping out so many words with the anthology?
Yeah, I've actually taken a much needed break, and it's been feeling really good, not because I'm not writing, but because I feel like I'm having time to just kind of reset. I visited family for a week. After I submitted October 1st, I just took about a month off now. And as the middle of the month happens, I'm starting to feel the need to write again. So no writing updates, but feeling very good about the beta feedback I've received. I'm starting to feel the urge to edit again. So I'm trying to follow the natural progression of that. What about you, Ben? Do you have any writing updates for us? Have you been doing any?
I have been doing a lot of writing. So I know I'm here to talk about my latest release, which is my third book, but I actually just finished, probably within the last 2 weeks, the draft of my next book, which is unrelated to the current series. It's a new concept. So I finished that draft, and I'm already 8,500 words into the fifth book, which is unrelated to the first two.
Love it.
It's two concepts that I've been kicking around for pretty much the entire time that I was writing my other books. I was like, well, when I'm done with these, I'm going to write these two books. So I'm doing unofficial novel writing month, because obviously that particular organization is, you know, persona non grata to a lot of us. Unofficial challenge going with another fantastic indie author, Poppy Alexander's, where we're trying to hit 70K in the next 2 months.
That's awesome. Those are great goals.
Yeah, very cool. Very ambitious. Sounds like you are a productive writer, Ben, much more than me.
Same.
I don't remember if I had done given the same update on the last episode, but I have wrapped up my Blades for Hire story. I'm just in the editing phase now. But I also have been taking a little bit of a break between now and letting everybody put their feedback on the doc and things like that. But yeah, I'm feeling the urge to get back into my docs and my drafts and start writing some more. It's about time.
Agreed. I feel like the darker evenings and the colder weather tend to be my more productive times of the year. Just, you know,
right.
Chilly, not much to do outside with friends. So just get to work.
Yeah, for sure. All right. Well, Ben, we have a few fun writing topics to dive into before we dive into like the meat of the interview questions and things like that. So I'm going to start off with the first one. This is a fun question that I came up with. And I want to know, what is the strangest place that you've found yourself writing in? Or even if you, maybe if it's not writing, thinking about your story and, you know, brainstorming ideas. And then we'll leave it at that. And then I'll let Ash ask her follow-up.
So for me?
Yeah, this is for you.
So I don't write in a lot of weird places. I will say, like, I've written in some, like, not super comfortable ones. Like, mm-hmm. I took a family vacation to Lake Tahoe to visit some family, and I was writing on a tablet folio on my lap in the airport. And so, like, that was certainly, like, the most contortionist I've been writing. But I definitely think about my writing everywhere. Which is, you know, as authors, you know, we would love to not have intrusive thoughts about our books at all times. So, you know, most the strangest place is while in the middle of doing other things that I should absolutely not be thinking about my book during.
Yeah.
I think we can all relate to that for sure. Is this an important meeting I need to be listening to? Just kidding. You're going to be thinking about your book instead. Yeah, for sure. All right. So I guess my follow up to that question is, you know, when you're doing this or when you're thinking about it, does it result in some of your was this part of your question, Brandon? Sorry if I cut that.
No, this was your follow up. Sorry.
Okay. Yeah. So did it result in some of your best work? And when you are writing outside the home, what's your go to tool if you find yourself? It sounds like you use like a tablet and a folio and it's not comfortable, but it does the job. What are we working with here?
Yeah, so whether it is my best work is always debatable, because again, when we write it, oftentimes we think it's our worst work until we get a chance to reread it again. We're like, oh, that wasn't so bad. But I will say, like, when I'm writing outside of the home, I get a lot done. Like, it's almost like a ritual to me. I know I've talked about this elsewhere, but like my partner and I, we call it coffee shop time, where we go to a coffee shop and they have like knitting or a book, and I have either my tablet or I'm actually using a Chromebook now because it's easier and it stands up by itself on like a folio, which that doesn't do that. So I find myself being the most productive when I'm in those kinds of places because I literally have nothing else to do. I have come there specifically to do this thing, and I just kind of sit down and crank it out. And like I said, a Chromebook is what I'm working with now because I do most of my drafting on Google Docs. And you can get them like old school ones super for like $30 on eBay. So it was convenient.
Nice.
Yeah, Chromebooks are great for like if you just need something to write on. They're perfect and very cost effective.
Yeah, I've heard the same in regards to that. I used to use, until very, very recently, like as in this year, my old laptop just wasn't cutting it. So I was doing a folio iPad situation too, and it did what it needed to do. But yes, very much uncomfortable. I've also, after a conversation with my partner, we were agreeing that we need to get out of the house to be more creative sometimes. Like I need to start doing the coffee shop kind of writing moments, just spend a couple hours on a Saturday morning doing that. I tend to get pigeonholed into my space. So it's a good reminder to do that.
Highly recommend it. And I will say though, some of the best ideas that I've had have been like while driving. And so my voice notes to remind myself to take a note the next day are unhinged.
Yeah.
I hate when I get those when I'm driving.
Yes. It's the same when falling asleep too for me. And then I have to like open up my phone and like the bright light gets me and I'm like, dang it. All right. I have to start over again. But this idea was too important not to jot down. So yeah.
For me, when I'm in a strange place, it's usually like a doctor's appointment or the airport or work. And I have to put down the notes in my phone. And I don't know if, you guys feel this way, but I absolutely hate writing on my phone to the point where if I have to text somebody a long text message, I will take out my laptop and open up a doc and type, and then I'll copy it from my phone because I don't want to do the long form text message on my phone. So
agreed.
I try to avoid that if I can, but sometimes I only have my phone and I really need to get the ideas down. And then my fingers are like cramping afterwards because I have, I guess, either large hands or a small phone. I don't know which it is, but
maybe both.
Maybe. Both. All right. Let's move into our second topic. Keeping in the theme of strange things, what, you know, writers are known for sometimes having questionable search histories. I think that's kind of a meme in the writing community. So I want to know, Ben, what is the weirdest thing you've had to research for your novels? Is there anything in particular that stands out for you as like that might not look good in my Google history?
So I'll talk. So for the book that I just finished drafting, I had two weird searches. One was, how quickly can I get a fully genotyped DNA results? And then the other one was, how much does a big plastic, like a black contractor garbage bag full of tobacco weigh? That was a
it's so specific.
It is weirdly specific. I'll let you know when that book eventually comes out, but it is oddly specific. And for my latest book, the very first line involves this, but I had to research what a shovel full of dirt weighs on average.
Interesting.
I feel like These are things that I would be so stubborn that like I wouldn't believe the search results. I would need to go and buy the shovel and buy the scale and test it for myself. And then that way, when someone comes at me with the, that's not realistic, I can say, take a picture of the scale with the dirt. And, you know, that's just me though.
Yeah.
What about you, Ash? Is there anything really strange you've had to research for your writing?
I don't know if strange is the right word, but I definitely have looked up like the minutia of different parts of a castle versus like other, like there's different kinds of castles, right? So like architecture stuff in that regard gets very specific, and it's harder when you don't know the words for the things you need to search for, you know, like what is a barbican, you know, and you have to use your research skills for that. Also different types of mythology, like a Bladuith is some obscure creature that I saw in a story one time and then had to go track that down. So mythology, I think, is the weirdest one, and trying to pronounce them and type them out and then Google being like, we don't know what you're talking about, can you figure that out? So yeah, nothing super crazy yet, but definitely those more medieval aspects of life. What about you, Brandon? Do you have any weird ones?
I wouldn't say weird. It's just the, like, I like to write detailed, like, combat sequences. And so sometimes that results in having to find out information about, like, how certain wounds might work. And so that might, I try to word that in a way that doesn't, like, flag Google, like, to check my next searches. Like, they're not contacting like the manual moderation team or whatever, but yeah, no, all jokes aside, it's really, that's probably the weirdest thing I've had to search. But outside of that, it's just like really niche things, like you said, like medieval terminology that I don't,
yeah,
I'm not familiar with, or like a mythology rabbit hole that I want to go down.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't think anything super strange has like made it into my Google search history. Not yet.
Yeah, Ben, we'll I think you take the title for strangest of the three of us today. I'm sure there are more out there, but yeah, you take the
I probably got some weirder ones laying around in there. Just that's the most like my books deal a lot with mythology, different mm-hmm. different mythologies. So like I'm in the same boat.
Yeah. Love it.
All right. Well, we got one more fun writing topic to get into. And this is actually a repeated question because I just thought it was so fun to dive into last time. So I wanted to pose the question to you, Ben, as well. I want to know the best writing advice you've ever received and then also the worst writing advice you've received and how both have affected your writing.
Okay. So let's start with the best. So the best writing advice is advice that I generally give. And I don't mean because I give it. I mean, it was good advice that I got. And so I pass it on. Because I realized as I said that, it sounded incredibly pretentious. The best writing advice I was given, which I always pass on, is you can't publish a book that doesn't exist. So words on the page is the only thing that matters. I'm pretty sure Stephen King is one of the authors that has said words on the page is the only thing that counts. And I try to do that in that, you know, I don't self-edit while you're writing, just get it out there. It's either going to be good or bad, but either way, it's going to exist 100% more than if you didn't write it in the first place.
Yeah, I'm really bad with that self-editing as you go rule.
Me too.
Don't do it.
I know.
It's so hard. But Ben, I think that's like genuinely, it's good to be reminded of that. Like very simple fact. I think a lot of us, me in particular, get caught up in the, I need to hit this many words, especially around the NaNoWriMo season. You know, everyone's doing their thing. I'm not participating, but you know, you see everyone else's word count and you're like, oh dang, okay, I need to really start to grind. But it is a good, very humbling reminder that the word counts, the goals can't happen until you actually sit down to write. So I think that's great advice.
Yeah. Bad advice.
Yes.
Yes, your worst advice.
So the worst advice, and I'll just say this is like general book talk, like stuff that is being peddled as advice. And frankly, I can't stand it. There's really two of them that are like the worst. And the first is to not use adverbs. I don't know who decided that they had a grudge against adverbs and that you couldn't use them, but like the idea that using an adverb somehow magically makes your writing lazy or, you know, your prose too flowery or like, there's something about a lack of adverbs that makes writing so utilitarian that like I can't even imagine it being enjoyable to read long term. It's like, where's the descriptive words? It's like, I know that those are adjectives, but like the adverbs, like,
yeah,
like there's only so many words for run. Sometimes I will have to use an adverb to modify that word.
Yeah.
And so like this, you know, you have to use, you can't use adverbs is nonsense that I've heard being given as advice before.
Was there a second one you said, or just was it the adverbs?
No, there was, but I've completely lost track of what it was. So it's like if it comes to me, I'll let you know. But like adverbs was really one of the worst pieces of advice.
Mm. Yeah, that's a good point. In my own writing, I do try to limit my use of adverbs just so it doesn't become too egregious. I like to try and get creative with how I describe certain actions and things like that. But I'm definitely not in the camp of like no adverbs ever. I find it interesting when people give you writing advice and it turns out to be you can't use this aspect of the language. I always thought that was very strange because the art of writing is, you know, using language to tell a story. So creating those arbitrary limitations of what kind of words you can and cannot use feels very weird when the point is to, you know, paint a vivid picture for the reader and tell a story in the most effective way possible. That's why whenever I get advice that says never use this type of word or always use this type of word, I very rarely take it to heart.
I remember the second one. The second one was and this guy got absolutely roasted off of TikTok. Was the guy who said that the only dialogue tag you should ever use is said.
And yes. We talked about this, yes.
That's my worst one, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, like it's terrible too, because it's like, so for both of those, for using adverbs and for other dialogue tags, if I picked up like the number one best-selling book on any list right now and I cracked it open, I would find both an adverb and a dialogue tag that isn't said. So like, sure, I don't have an MFA in creative writing, but like, I'm pretty sure we're allowed to do these things.
Yeah. I like that you mentioned actually picking up a book, because that's exactly what I did when I heard that advice. I picked up my favorite book, Game of Thrones. So I picked that up. I opened it. Sure enough, there's plenty of dialogue tags in the first chapter that are not said. And so immediately that tells me if George R. R. Martin is allowed to do it, maybe it's fine for everybody else to do it. Like, not that there's, you know, not that that applies to every piece of advice, because some people, you know, have honed their craft to a point where they know when to break certain rules better than maybe I would. But as far as the dialogue tags, I don't think I've read a single book that I can think of that has taken that rule and actually applied it. So that's just a very strange piece of advice that I will never understand. Because even with the adverbs, I apply that kind of liberally to where like I just try to limit my use of them, but not outright, you know, ban them from my drafts. But with the dialogue tags, I don't even think about that.
Me neither. Yeah, I think, Brandon, some of like one of your biggest pieces of advice for me on the beta was like, maybe limit the adverbs a bit. And I, unfortunately, am a lover of them all, but also a really good reminder that balance is important and we can work on craft way more, especially in the editing phase. It's like, all right, take that out. How can I say this differently? But yeah, I love adverbs.
Yeah. Yeah. And when I read them in your story, there was just a few examples that I thought they weren't needed. Not that you should take them all out completely.
No, definitely. It's a good reminder, because that's exactly what beta reading is for, is like, hey, notice there's just a little bit more in certain areas than you probably don't need. And it's like, yeah, when you're in the heat of the moment and the words are flowing, you're not thinking of like, I'm using another adverb, I gotta, right? Especially if we're not trying to edit while we write. So it's just like on paper, get it out and then you can refine later. But great advice. Always use adverbs. Not always, but don't be afraid of them. And also don't be afraid of anything other than said.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we can finally move into our actual interview questions for the day, Ben. Ash, I'm going to let you lead with the first one, if that's all right.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So it's a pretty easy softball question for you. Give us a brief overview of your novel or your novels and any previous writing experience you had before you published your first.
So you are author, so you know how difficult it is to summarize anything.
Yeah.
In fact, I joke that I'm a self-published author because I cannot write a synopsis. So there's no way that I could query anything because I would have to first write a synopsis. So I'm just going to skip that and self-publish. So I have three books out right now, and they're all part of a series called The Devil You Know. The first book is called My Boss is the Devil, and it starts with the story of this down on his luck barista named Nick in New Haven, Connecticut. And he gets the chance of a lifetime to change his life by going to work for the devil. The series follows his progression. You know, the first, I know it's a podcast in many cases, but we got cameras. So this is the first book, My Boss is the Devil. So this follows, this is Nick and his journey for whether or not he decides to go work for the devil, because the devil is a gambling man and gives him a chance to basically test drive his new life before he has to make a decision. But it is not what you expect. The second book is called Dueling Shoulder Angels, and Dueling Shoulder Angels continues Nick's story 2 years later. And whereas the first book introduces Lucifer, the second book introduces God. And I assure you, this God is not going to be what you expect. And then the third book, which just came out October 15th, which is my latest one, which is called Too Many Gods in the Kitchen. So Too Many Gods in the Kitchen follows the story of Nick and his friends. So the cast of characters, most of which continue through the three books, are introduced in book one. But in book two, the goth witch from book one gets a much stronger role. She's also the love interest. There is some very light romance. It's not in any way a focus. So there's like, I'll call it a romantic subplot that you know, is important, but it is not like, it's also, what's the word? Zero peppers. There's no spice in these books.
No spice. Yeah, got it.
And then, so Dueling Shoulder Angels gives Amy a much bigger role. And then Too Many Gods in the Kitchen continues with two of them. And another character that was reintroduced in book two that I can't go into without spoiling things. But whereas the first two books introduce God and the devil, the third book introduces additional non-Abrahamic pantheons. So it branches out and then kind of, it closes the series, but opens the future for other books.
I think that was a great synopsis. Just, I mean, you have three books and you succinctly discussed each one and then connected them all together. So no notes there. It sounds Perfect. Very, very much similar to, what is his name? I think it's Henry Neff. He just came out very similar, like urban fantasy, devils and angels, but funny. And then, yeah, like, I know we can't really discuss him much anymore, but Neil Gaiman's American Gods kind of just like adding, you know, to the daily lives of these deities. So that's really interesting. Did you have any previous writing experience or is that like, is this new?
So I wrote different formats for a long time. Like in elementary school, I wrote short stories. In high school, I was goth, so I wrote a lot of poetry. Allegedly, it was good. I don't know that any record of it still exists to this day.
Dang.
Though I do occasionally want to get back in touch with my AP English teacher because he said that if I don't do something with my creative writing at some point, he was going to hunt me down. So I'll have to see whether or not I can catch up with him at some point.
Yeah, you should.
So My Boss is the Devil has a funny story in that I started drafting it more than 10 years ago. I don't want to say how many more than 10 because A, I don't remember and B, I'd be dating myself. So I started writing it when I was in a dead-end job and then I shelved it for a long time. And then during NaNoWriMo 2014, so 10 years ago, I picked it up and finished the first draft. So I've been writing for a long time. Just I had not been very productive until recently, but then that all changed because once I was about to publish book one, I wrote 90% of book two in NaNoWriMo 2023. And then I wrote all of book three in like 3 months earlier this year. So I've been very productive.
What was the my last question on this topic, and then I'll hand it off to Brandon to go into the next. But my question, I guess, is what gave you the push to want to like actually publish after doing it just, you know, for fun for so long? Like, what was that? What was the shift for you?
Okay, so I don't know. I'm sure you all know Atomic Apple Pie here on the Clock app. She's the one that reads like bad romance prose written by men.
I'm not familiar, but now I'm interested.
Familiar, but now I need to find.
So like pure shout out. And I've told her this. I have said to Atomic Apple Pie that like she is the reason that I published my first book.
Oh my gosh.
The reason is I was putting my son to bed and I was listening to one of her videos and she reads this absolute awful writing. And I said to myself, I wrote a book. I wrote a whole book. And it's been years. And like my book isn't published. Why isn't my book published when all of these terrible, terrible writers, like, and to be fair, maybe the rest of their writing is good, but like the spicy stuff that they're writing is hideously bad. So like, I don't have, like, they can come for me if they want. But like, that was the genesis of this, is that I literally was on TikTok and heard bad prose written by other people and said, it can't be as bad as this. So I should probably publish my book.
I love that. No, I think a lot of us kind of feel or felt similarly when we started the official journey. You know, you just kind of like, well, yeah, if they can do it, I can do it, you know, and if not anything more than just that. So, yeah, that's excellent.
I just wanted to highlight, Ben, you and I both had a shared experience, it sounds like, with a very positive AP English teacher who encouraged creative pursuits. So that was very cool to hear, because I know that was really influential on me in high school. Like, out of all the classes that I remember material from, that's the number one. So, all right, I'll move into our next question. But actually, Ash, I'm going to throw one in there that I forgot to put in
the doc
because he just showed off these beautiful covers.
Yes.
One, I love the style of those covers for the whole series.
Thank you. They just
show them off again.
Yeah, I love them.
They're all really cool. So I wanted to ask you about the cover design process for, I guess, the whole series, because it looks like they all have a pretty uniform style. Mm-hmm. So what was the process like for you? Did you have like a specific vision in mind? Did you work with the cover designer? Did you do them yourself? How did it go?
I am an artist, but I am not that artist. I write books. I don't do cover design. So yeah, I had a vision from a long time ago that it was effectively like the silhouette of a man on signs or restrooms or whatever. It's just that stick figure of a guy with like devil horns holding a briefcase. Like, that was my initial concept for the cover of the first book. And I worked with Get Covers. So getcovers.com is the budget arm of Miblart. And they are, is it Romain? They're somewhere in, I believe, Eastern Europe, but they're real human designers. They don't use AI. They basically take a selection of, you choose some stock imagery that you like, and then they build a cover around it. I didn't do that because I'm a pain in the butt. I sent them feedback and I said, it's like this with this feel and that. And they sent me a cover and it had nothing to do with anything that I wanted. So I said, okay, I skipped the part where I sent you things. So now we need to send you things. And I found like some comparable covers that had that kind of silhouette, not photorealistic feel, you know, that's mm-hmm. like, I've got the faceless character with the devil behind him. And so I sent them a few covers and said, more like this. And then that started down the road of like success. Mm-hmm. And the nice thing about Get Covers is A, it's cheap because publishing books is expensive. And B, you get unlimited revisions, meaning as long as you can suffer going back and forth with the designer, or technically with the project manager of the designer, you can narrow down towards where you want to go. And so probably like 15 revisions later, I had this cover. And then the next two books, I used them again. I said, hey, you know, I want it like this, only, you know, so like you have to be ready to like to do the work. It's like, okay, like this, only green. No, yes. Not that green. I want to and literally I had to send them a picture of the eponymous millennial green velvet couch and say, no, this green. So like, if anyone's wondering, this is green velvet couch green, you know, and it expands. So now we've got, you know, we've got Nick and Amy on the cover with God and the devil. And then the next one was, okay, like book two, only only not. So now we've got three characters and three different deities. So yeah, it's a good process. Again, minimum of 15 revisions each to get to where I wanted to be. But they were great to work with.
Yeah, we got a comment from Seth. He's worked with Miblart on his rebrand for the Eldritch Depths series, and I actually just commissioned them for the Blades for Hire anthology. So they really are great at what they do, so can't go wrong with them. And as we can see from the covers they did for you, they put out pretty great stuff.
Yeah, and like, I know they have their like higher end division,
right?
But like, I've been very happy with the budget arm. And what I will say is they're also great at, if you have a cover that you're not happy with, like let's say you designed your own cover and you're like, look, I really love this, but I know that I need this to. So one of the biggest criticisms of self-published books is their covers are bad. It doesn't mean that they are, but I'm like, one of the biggest criticisms is like self-published books, you can tell because of the covers. And it's like, that's A, that's not always true, but B, like there's an easy fix to that, which is have your covers professionally done. And you can take a cover that you did and say, well, this needs polish. And you can ship it off to Get Covers and say, like this only better. And they'll do it. Like in one of the writer discords I'm in, one of the authors sent his cover to them and said, like, this is a concept, but I want it to be more genre appropriate. And the cover they sent back was stunning.
Yeah. I also liked what you said about I'm an artist, but not that artist, because I'm a designer. I do web design, but I can't do book covers. It's a totally different, you know, skill set. And I've tried for like hours and hours, and I've come to the realization that I either need to put a lot of time into learning this craft of design, or I can just pay for it. And I'd rather just pay for it. So, and like you said, they have like a wide range of options for different budgets and things like that. So that's also great. But yeah, because some people will ask me like, you're a designer, why don't you design your own cover? And I'm like, it's not that simple. There are many different subsets of design, and that is not one that I am particularly skilled in. As much as I would love to be, you know, it would be great to be able to design my own covers that well, but it's just not the case.
Yeah, I think we'll see. My prediction is, you know, I don't think, and I could be wrong, they might have existed well before, you know, this, but the rise in self-publishing, I think, will then, you know, see a rise in more sites and companies like this in order to meet the need, which is great because it's, you know, one, a rising industry, and two, yeah, where there's a gap in the market, people will fill it. So good to know that there are options out there for anyone, you know, whatever the budget. And I think that's, like you mentioned, I mean, self-publishing gets bad flack for that exact reason, but then you forget people are putting all of their money into this, or as much as they can feasibly. And sometimes, you know, you can't hire a, you know, Instagram famous author or artist to do your covers. Yeah. So
yeah,
you
know, we can't all afford, you know, Chris McGrath covers, right, for our Dresden series knockoffs.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Ash, I'll let you pick the next question from our list here.
Yeah, I guess that's a good segue into, you know, kind of like, we'll go back to the process, but since we're kind of on the topic of book covers, what was your publishing process like? I mean, how did you decide what platform to use? What were your goals for the book? Kind of talk about the objectives that you had when you
began. Sure. It's a great question, because other big piece of advice that I've gotten that I continue to give is decide why you want to publish, because why you want to publish will determine not just how you publish, but also what you write. Because if you're publishing to sell books, then writing to the market is more important to you. If you're publishing to get your story out there, then it isn't as important what you write, so long as you are willing to accept the risk of publishing that something that may or may not fit the market. So my goal with publishing was to get my story told. I had a book that's been burning a hole in my pocket for a decade plus, and I wanted it out there. I wanted people to read it because I thought it was entertaining. It's a dark comedy. It's sarcastic and funny, and it's got good characters and dialogue, and no one can read it if I don't publish it. I went the first book I had professionally edited a long time back. So I didn't do another round of professional editing when I added like 10 to 15,000 words. So I didn't do another pro round of editing, but I had a number of friends with writing backgrounds read it and help me with some editing. And then I did have a friend proofread it. But then I went through KDP, and I'm in the KDP Select, so Kindle Unlimited program. So that actually takes some of the what do I do out of it, because I don't have to worry about other platforms. My ebook is exclusive to them. I did figure out how to publish the paperback, not just on KDP, but also through Ingram Spark. Mostly so that if I can convince a library to order my book, they can order it through Ingram. I don't accept returns because I don't have money to burn. Like, getting into bookstores wasn't that important to me. So yeah, I published through KDP. I did the multiple formats, and then the process is kind of similar for book two. It was draft the book, get a couple beta readers, incorporate that feedback. I have an editor that's doing copy and line edits because I can't afford developmental editing. I mean, frankly, it's one of those weird things. I don't know who can afford developmental editing. Because, like, even for my books on the skinny, like 70 to 80K. So, like, they're in the range of books for the market. But even those books, getting those developmentally edited would be like thousands of dollars. So I don't do developmental edits. I do my best to get enough feedback from beta readers and whatnot. And then my editor goes through, I incorporate feedback from my editor, who is another indie author. And then I have another friend who proofreads it. When I say friends, like, these are two paid people. Like, I have it professionally copy and line edited. I have it professionally proofread. And then after that, while that happens, I've been working with the designer on the cover. And then I decide when to publish. And I have an advanced reader team and other signups that I go through to try to generate some early reviews. And, you know, that's kind of it.
Yeah, I think it's this, you know, we had guests on last episode and then this episode, and it's, so far the running theme seems to be just how awesome community is when it comes to the self-publishing process. I think for at least me, kind of starting on this journey and learning more about self-publishing, I didn't expect it to be so community-based and very community leaning, and I love hearing, you know, what you were saying, even though you pay them, right? Like, they are still people willing to help, or you have your beta reading and advanced copy community. So yeah, that's really interesting. How long was that process for you overall, like from beginning, like you've got your final draft, you're ready to go, the edits have been made, and then you send it to KDP? Like, what's the time frame for you on that?
So I don't do a long pre-order.
Okay.
The feedback that I've gotten is that setting a pre-order starts the clock on when the Zon will, like, promote your stuff. So I don't actually want to start the clock on that until the book is, like, almost available. So I do, like, a 1 to 2 week pre-order. But I'll say, from having, like, incorporating all of the edits, and so I format the book myself. I should have mentioned that I use Atticus for book formatting. I love it. It's simple. My books are not complex, so it's everything that I need. And then I will usually give around 2 months to give my ARC readers time to get through the book. Now, the challenge is, as the series gets bigger, getting new readers, I have to get them through the first two books to get to the third book, which, like, read through for advanced readers is much lower than for if it's like a standalone.
Yeah.
So I also have to do some management of that. But yeah, from being done with incorporating the edits and formatting to having it published is usually 2 to 3 months max.
Yeah. Wow. That seems really fast. I don't have any other gauge for that, but that seems to move pretty quickly.
Well, yeah. I mean, it really depends. Like, again, I don't need to have a long pre-order. There's right. no, so as an indie author, just like you can't publish a book that doesn't exist, you can't sell books that aren't available. So it's like, right. I don't want to do, like, the rapid release every 3 months, because I think I would probably expire. But, like, I've been putting out a book roughly every 6 months.
Yeah, and
that feels okay, but it does, for some people, that's fast. Like, I'm part of a local authors co-op in Connecticut, Massachusetts. We're actually publishing an anthology later this year of short stories. We publish under Caffeinated Terrier Press.
Cute.
And like one of our authors there, Dave Niemitz, he published his first book close to a year ago, and his second book is coming out in December. But his book's been ready. Like his book is ready to go. So it's his choice to wait that long. And different people do it for different reasons. But like, I can't sell a book that's not out there. So like, why wouldn't I put it out there?
Yeah. That's a fair point too.
Well, I will segue into the next question we have, moving from publishing over to marketing. So how did you handle the marketing of your books? Was it all done by yourself in the community? Did you enlist any third parties? And how did the overall marketing process go? And what lessons did you take from like book one into book two and book three's marketing?
Book one had the least care in its launch because I didn't know. I was getting ready to publish at the same time I was just getting into the community. Like I literally was getting ready to self-publish my first book, not having dived into the rich, helpful community that Ash mentions. And like, it totally is. Like, indie authors get that we are not in competition with each other, because if we were, there would only be a handful of books in the world. But there are so many people and so many books that it doesn't make any sense for us to be in competition with each other. So we might as well help each other out. And it's very much that a rising tide raises all ships kind of mentality. So for book one, I didn't do any of that. I tried to do word of mouth. I did pay a couple marketers on Fiverr to do some like email list campaigns and some other stuff, and I basically got nothing out of it.
Trial and error.
You got to try something. And
yeah,
like,
right.
You dip your toe in with the things that don't cost too much. So it's like, I can spend $15 on Fiverr for something that may or may not pan out. Like, but like the last thing you should do is pay some marketing firm, you know, thousands of dollars, because you're going to get nothing out of that. The only thing that I have learned so far about marketing is that everyone's going to have to do it themselves. Even if you are a trad published author, if you are a new author, my understanding from many people, and this is like backed up from like some of the big names, you don't get support from the big five as a new author. They'll publish your book. It might be available in bookstores, but like you're going to be your own marketing and social media team because you're not a big name yet. They're not going to throw their weight behind you for like money and resources. Even in that situation, you're still going to end up doing the marketing yourself. I've tried to engage very regularly on this app, on the Clock app, and it hasn't panned out. Like I've got some really nice people that I've connected with and some readers, and that's great. But like, I'm not writing romantasy, so I'm not going viral. I've tried, I've done Amazon ads, which are mostly worthless to me. I've even done like a free Amazon ad author course, and I've tried to incorporate their feedback, and it's netted me nothing. The only ads that I pay for that are successful, and by successful, I mean people read my book, not that I make money, are Facebook ads.
Really?
Yeah. The only thing I see, you know, Kindle Unlimited page reads and occasional purchases are from my attribution links that are connected to my Facebook ads.
Wow.
Other than that, I mostly see my page reads through Kindle Unlimited. And that is, I get spikes because periodically I will do giveaways and sales. So I'll do a giveaway on book one, and then I'll do sales on book two and book three while I'm having a giveaway.
Sure.
And then I'll see a lot of, so I recently did one of Haley Anderton's Indie Visible book events. And if you don't know her, she's another person that's trying to do good things for the community. And so she hosts these events. And it's similar to like the Stuff Your Kindle stuff, but it's specifically a group called Indivisible. And just as an example, so I have a blog post on my website that goes through the numbers of how that worked and the how many books did I give away, how many books did I sell after that, what kind of page read spikes did I see. And like those are very successful for getting the book out there. I don't get a lot of ratings or reviews out of it, but like I do get a bump in the Amazon rankings and therefore I get additional push with Kindle Unlimited. But like most marketing has just been a terrible experimentation of things that don't work.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting you mentioned the Facebook ads because that's something that I hear actually commonly reiterated from everyone is that paid ads on 90% of platforms suck and they won't give you any return. But Facebook ads are a totally different beast. And if you're going to buy ads somewhere, that's where you should buy them.
That's so curious. Do we know why this is? Like offhand? No. Okay, I'll look into why. It.
They must just have a better algorithm for who they push it to or something. From what I've heard, I can't say if this is true or not because I haven't paid for TikTok ads, but from what I've heard with TikTok ads, when you buy it, they just push it to like random people. It's not targeted. It's not targeted to people who would be interested in like, say, a fantasy book. It's just literally, you know, if you pay for 200 views, you get 200 random people across the world who may not even know English. So when they're looking at your ad, it's like a foreign language. So it could just be some of these platforms have more refined algorithms for who they push to and how they know what those people's interests are. But that's just my total guess as someone who works in web design and development. Yeah. I don't know if that's the case or not. Ben, do you have any insights on that?
So not exactly, but there's a question in the TikTok chat from SM Campbell that I'd like to address just because I do have an answer for that one.
Okay.
So the question is, how do you know whether or not your Meta ads convert to sales? And you do that. And to be fair, this only works if you're selling through Amazon.
Mm.
Or at least I don't know if anyone else does this, but Amazon specifically has what are called attribution links. And you set up an attribution link that goes to the link to purchase the thing. And then when people click through an attribution link, Amazon then tracks whether or not that click converts to a sale or a page read. So
gotcha.
My current ads point to my series page because I'm testing that out. Some people do ads. And because again, when people say never, obviously we should not listen to them. But they say never do ads for a series, but only do ads for the first book. But I'm testing it out because I wanted to see. I have a complete series now. I want to see if that does anything for sales. So I'm going to do that for a little while and then switch back to just the first book and see if it makes a difference.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah.
So Ash, go ahead.
No, you go ahead, Brandon. Go for it.
I was just going to say, so it sounds like Amazon lets you create different links to connect to different ad platforms so you can like really identify which ones are converting and which ones aren't.
Clever.
Perfect.
Brandon's tired of hearing this, but I went to a writer's conference earlier this year and they did mention, especially if you are a self-published author, that completed series do much better in terms of ads and marketability than your first or second novel say. So yeah, hopefully for you that's a boost. I feel like people enjoy being able to binge read things. The time of waiting for the next release is no longer fun like it used to be in the past where you would go to like release events, you know?
It was never fun.
I enjoyed it. Maybe that's just me personally, but you know, I'm thinking of like the, you know, the big like Harry Potter or Twilight or something like that, those big kind of international novels. But yeah, I think people are impatient now and they want to get it all at once. So yeah, you'll have to come back in a few months and let us know how that worked out for you.
Yeah, totally will.
Ash, actually, I think it's your turn to pick it.
Sure. All right, let's see. Okay. All right. So let's kind of like work it back a little bit. Talk to us about your writing process. Is this something that so Brandon is doing a good job, I think, of trying to be consistent, you know, with his writing practice. Me, I fail every time. I just kind of pick it up when I can and go with the flow. So walk us through what a writing day looks like for you, or a week at least.
So I try to be consistent in that I want to try and write every day.
Okay.
If that's 200 words, great. If that's 2,000 words, great. But the whole point is I want to do something. And that's it. It doesn't always work. I'll have days where I don't. Like today may not be a writing day because I'm here with you folks, and then I got to go run an errand, and by the time I get back, I'm going to be like, eh. But then I'll have that idea, and then I'll do it anyway. But I try to make it convenient for myself. So again, like I've got my laptop, I've got my desktop, I've got my phone. God forbid if I decide that I need to. I also hate writing on my phone, Brandon.
Yeah.
So yeah, my process is to write at least a little bit every day to varying degrees of success. I will say, like, so I realize I have a microphone, so sorry folks listening to that one. I'm neurospicy like many of us. And so this has managed to be my hyperfixation for the last year. I'm just going to keep riding this wave until I can't anymore.
Love that.
But yeah,
attitude to have.
I try to just write a little bit every day. And sometimes that's going to be more than others, and that's okay. But again, just do your best to stick with it.
Yeah. Real quick, thank you, River, and everybody else for all the likes that you're giving. Really appreciate it. Yeah, Ben, I'm kind of in the same camp where I like to feel productive. And so there's a lot of things that I like to get done throughout the day. And it's like little bits of progress towards really large goals across multiple things, not just writing. But if I can write a little bit every day, I'm still working to, you know, getting that consistency. But if I can do that, you know, I get my workouts in and things like that. I feel happier. Like if I've contributed to multiple goals throughout the day, it gives me like this rush of energy and this like really positive feeling. And so that's how I like to approach things like writing and anything else that's going to be a long-term goal of mine. I like to try and do a little bit of something that pushes that goal further every day. Real quick, I got to do the TikTok verification. They make me drag a puzzle.
The puzzle piece.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's still there.
I do. So I sometimes do lives. Just as an aside, I mentioned that I'm also an audiobook narrator and producer. Mm-hmm. I also have to drag the puzzle piece periodically because I'll go live when I'm doing some recording.
Yeah, I think they just want to make sure you didn't fall asleep on live or something. I don't know what it is, but
probably. Really, yeah, you're just paying attention, I guess, and not like driving and filming or whatever.
Well, it's like the Netflix where it's like, are you still watching this? And it's like, hey, thanks for calling me out. Yes, I am.
But also, yes, please don't. I think Hulu does like don't ask again or something like that. Yeah. And I'm like, don't ask me that again. I know I'm watching this. Thanks.
There was, I forget what game system it was, but it used to tell you to go outside.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It would say, you've been playing this for a while. You should take a break.
Yeah.
I forget. I think it was a Nintendo console, but I don't remember.
I was literally going to say, I think that sounds like Nintendo. Like,
yeah.
Was it the Nintendo? Yeah. Oh, gosh. Goodness gracious.
Same energy, though.
Very much that. I mean, I appreciate it, but I don't need it. Thank you.
Sorry, I'm trying to pick a good question from our list here. Okay. Because we touched on some of these a little bit. So, okay, here's a good one. Tell us a little bit about your writing tools. I know we talked about like your laptop and how we both are averse to writing on a phone, but there's a wide spectrum of like writing software out there that people like to use. Some, like me, prefer the most simple thing you can get. Others like really complex tools that you can kind of move scenes around and things like Scrivener. So what do you find yourself using when you're writing your drafts?
Yeah, so for drafting, I use Google Docs. Mm-hmm. But that's also because it's really convenient for if I'm going to have someone doing like an alpha read, and that way I can share it with them and their shared comments and other things. Atticus has a writing functionality, but I don't think anyone actually uses it. And I don't necessarily recommend it because I have heard things about people losing data from it. So I will use it to format my books, but I'm not currently interested in writing with it.
Mm-hmm.
during the editing phase, because like you do a round of, I do a round of self edits, probably more like two rounds of self edits first before involving beta readers. And I have Pro Writing Aid, which is like a Grammarly kind of tool, only better. I will say specifically, I have turned off any AI functionality that exists in the tool. Like, I don't think it's bad to say, like, I have the largest bone to pick with generative AI, and like many other self-published and indie authors, it's a problem. So I'll use Pro Writing Aid, but I only use the algorithmic pieces, not the generative AI pieces. So I turn those off. So I'm really mostly just using it to like check punctuation. It calls out things like passive voice, so I can see whether or not I really actually want passive voice there, which I usually don't, for the record.
Yeah.
So it's good at calling that out. But other than that, it's better than Grammarly, and you can often get like a lifetime pro license for it on sale. So I took advantage of that at one point. So I use Pro Writing Aid. You will use Microsoft Word during a round of self edits, because I have two macros that I use. One of which, I use them both at once, but it highlights filter words in one color. So, you know, filter words like saw, you know, the words that that separate your reader from the experience. So it highlights filter words and it highlights junk words. I have a list of both that I've used. So like just or that or, you know. So I use Microsoft Word to run those macros to then go through a round of self edits and take care of those things. And then, like I said, once I get it feedback back from beta readers and then my edits back from my editor, I'll then, and proofreader. Once I get it back and it's ready for formatting, I put it through Atticus and I format my books. And that's most of the tools that I use, I think. Like for recording audiobooks, there's a whole separate pile of tool,
yeah,
that I'm happy to talk about, but that's not the focus of this podcast.
Yeah, I imagine audiobooks are a whole different beast.
God, I can't imagine.
just getting the audio on this podcast was a journey.
It was
to get it in a good place. And sometimes there's still hiccups, like when we have sometimes when we have a guest or something. So,
yeah,
you know, it's I've always envied people who can manage audio really well, like record, and you know, they know all the things. I know Ash's partner is like a video and audio whiz, so
yeah, I don't know how he does it really. I'm just kind of like, what? Okay.
yeah.
I can't talk about it.
Right.
Yeah, my first audiobook just came out. Like I just published it like last week or the week before. So yeah, I can't say whether or not I do it well. I do it well enough that they approved it, and people seem to like it so far. But like, yeah, it's definitely been a challenge getting into that.
So, is the audiobook a different audiobook, or is this an audiobook of your own book? So you did your own audiobook.
Yeah, read
yeah,
by the
okay.
By the author.
By the author. So walk us through what made you choose to do that. Was it just cost effective, or was it the way you wanted to tell the story needed to come through in only the way you could read it?
There's a lot of reasons. One is cost, obviously. I did get auditions to have someone else do the audiobook, but then I was staring down the barrel of three books.
Mm.
And so I have a background in acting. I do voices and accents and other things. So I did a test. I took like the 10 auditions that I had that I liked, and I did an audition for myself, and I sent it to a friend of mine, two friends, and said, how does what I did compare to this? And one of them said, regardless, I want it read by an author. Because some people, that's like really their jam. They want a book narrated by the author. And then my other friend said, yeah, you sound fine. If you want to do the book yourself, you should do that. There's another much more sentimental reason, which is, so my mom hasn't been well for a very long time. And I don't tell this story for sympathy, but like it sounds that way. But, you know, she's had a couple strokes, and so she can't read like printed word anymore. And the funny thing is, I read a draft of my book to her a long time ago, probably close to the 8 to 10 year mark, when she was in the hospital. So like I was there in the ER with her, keeping her entertained for a few hours, reading her my book. Thinking about it, not only is it cost effective, it's not time effective for the record. It costs a lot of time to do it, but like actual like cash money outlay is different. So it's cost effective, but also I wanted my mom to be able to hear my book in my voice. So there's actually a dedication in the audiobook that doesn't exist in the written book that is for my mom.
Yeah. I know you don't. We're not in like Instagram close friends, but Brandon
we could be.
Knows this. We could be. Every random week, something will make me cry, and I go on and I say, "Here's what made Ash cry this week," and it'll be something like two geese falling in love or something like that. This would have been my this week. It's very sweet, very sentimental, but also a really good reminder to many of us when we're thinking of like readership that we don't realize that, you know.
Accessibility is huge.
Yeah, absolutely. No, 100%. So thanks for that reminder. That's awesome.
Yeah, audiobooks are a huge market, especially for, you know, people who have visual impairments. As someone who works in web design, I have to make things accessible like on a daily basis. So that's always kind of been kind of in the back of my mind with my writing is like, I really want to get an audiobook out. For any books I put out like as soon as possible. So there's not that gap for anyone who might not be able to pick up the ebook or the print copy. But
yeah,
I forgot where I was going with that.
When you want to talk about your options, let me know.
For sure. I had a train of thought that I was going to follow, Ben, and I lost it. So I'm really sorry, but
it's okay.
I'll move on to this question. I want to talk a little bit about your long-term writing goals. So it sounds like you have been writing for a decent amount of time, but do you have any like long-term goals that you've still yet to hit as a writer? Do you plan on writing into any different genres or formats like screenwriting or, you know, anything else like that? I mean, you're already doing audiobooks, which is pretty cool. So just tell us a little bit about what your overall writing journey vision is, I guess.
So, I mean, I write urban fantasy because it's one of my favorite genres.
Mm-hmm.
So I have my three books in the current series. I have the draft of the new book, so the way I describe the new book is it's Harry Dresden meets Indiana Jones, but works for Greenpeace in Lee Bardugo's Ninth House.
That's amazing.
It's effectively, it's a take on urban fantasy that focuses on the native and indigenous myths of Connecticut, and specifically the New Haven area, which it was traditionally the home of a tribe called the Quinnipiac. There are other tribes in the area, like there's the Golden Hill Pogosets. Over to the east, there's the Mohegan Reservation and the Mashantucket Pequots. But in New Haven, I'm weird. So New Haven is my main. So like Stephen King, half of his books happen in Maine. And they're, even though he says that all of his books are like in the same world, they're all vastly different and the magic and other stuff works differently. All of my books so far take place in New Haven. So the first three books are in this one reality of New Haven. This new book is considered an alternate reality of New Haven. So it's still urban fantasy. Magic is still real. But it's different characters and the focus is different. And it focuses on the main character trying to preserve effectively the indigenous spiritual life. So it's actually, the intention of it is to be both entertaining and somewhat anti-colonial and anti-capitalist, So I have that book that just I just drafted that is in Alpha Reads. So that may very well be a series by itself, because I think there's more to tell with that character. And then I'm writing another book, which is in a different alternate reality of New Haven, that is actually focused on Jewish mystics. So my family is Jewish. I say my family is Jewish in that, like, I'm culturally Jewish, but like I'm Jew-ish. I don't practice. There's Jewish mysticism is fascinating, and I don't think that there's enough urban fantasy with Jewish main characters. So I'm writing this urban fantasy that has a gritty noir detective feel to it, but it's focused on Jewish mysticism and that as the magic system. So
Very cool.
My long-term goals are to keep writing these things, because like these are three different series that are going to keep me busy for a while. I feel like I have an epic fantasy in me somewhere, but I still feel like I'm going to be a contrarian and turn it into an epic urban fantasy, because it's going to be like New Haven only after an apocalypse where technology has regressed.
Interesting. Yeah, it sounds like you've got a lot of threads, but all very passionate threads to follow. So that's awesome. We'll have to have you back when you're on your, you know, 14th book.
If you had asked me, so the funny thing is, I've really only been writing seriously for the past like year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
If you had asked me a year ago, hey, did you know that in a year you're going to have three published books? I would have called you insane. So yeah, I don't know. Sky's the limit.
That's so exciting. You mentioned, like, you know, Stephen King having his area, and then you mentioned your book being like this and this author, kind of their stories combined. Give us some background into like what type of books raised you. What did you read as a kid? What influenced your urban fantasy love?
So earliest, I would actually say I was probably into epic fantasy before I was into urban fantasy. My mom would buy trash bags of books at tag sales. Like, my mom was a tag sailor, like nobody's business. That was what she did. And she would just bring home bags, and I would then piece together series out of the books. Like, she didn't know what they were. She would just say to the person, I'll give you $5 for this whole bag of books.
Sure.
And so I read so many books that I probably never would have found otherwise, just because they got brought home when I was like a young teen to like late teen, early adult.
Mm-hmm.
And so like the books that raised me were like Dragonlance, you know, Margaret Weiss and Tracy Hickman, all of those books. Well, I read a lot of different epic fantasy. Like, I've read so many books that it's hard to remember which books I have read.
Sure.
But as far as urban fantasy goes, I love the Harry Dresden books, though I've only read them up until like whatever he published probably 4 or 5 years ago. One of my favorite urban fantasy authors, who I have emailed and I wish that he would write me back, is Charles DeLint. I don't know if you know Charles DeLint, but he writes urban fantasy, or he wrote urban fantasy. I don't think anything's come out in a while. In a fictional Canadian city called Newford.
Mm-hmm.
So he was, and a lot of his books focused on and other indigenous myths, because in that area he writes based on like the Kickahaw as far as those tribes. So there's a lot of stuff about raven and crow and coyote. And so a lot of the inspiration for my books comes from Charles DeLint's books. Some of it comes from, you know, Jim Butcher and those, but like I've read so many.
That's a good problem to have, to not remember what you've read, because you've read so much. Genuinely, I don't think anyone would argue with that.
It's also the ADHD. Like, don't ask me what I did last week. So it's like, it's all in there somewhere.
Right. Well, actually, Ash, I was going to pick another question, but I think we touched on most of our interview questions here. So Ben, this is usually the time where we open it to the audience, if anyone is still with us, to ask any questions that they might have. So I will open the floor to anyone who might still be with us. But do you have any maybe closing thoughts that you'd like to share? Any news, anything? any words of wisdom that you'd like to share with the audience or with us before we sign off?
So I wouldn't mind talking about the fact that I'm also now recording the audio for book two. So yeah. Dueling Shoulder Angels, I just started recording yesterday, and I'm a chapter into it. So I'm hoping to have that done in the relatively near future. So for those of you who are neurospicy like me, don't pick up too many projects at once, because eventually your demand avoidance is going to tell you that you can't do any of them. So I have found,
amen to that,
I can do two things at once. Okay, so I can write a book and edit another one. I can edit a book and record an audiobook.
Right.
But I cannot write a book, edit a book, and record an audiobook, because then I shut down completely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So know your limits. Know what it is that you can do consistently. And if all you can do consistently is write 100 words a night, do that.
Yeah.
Because it's still better than the 0 words you would have written without doing that. But yeah, I'm excited to have more books out. I really love this community. So thank you, Ash and Brandon, for having me on, because this is one of the joys of being involved in the indie community, is being able to talk with other indie authors. And like, I know that we have to hustle where we can. And for the record, I despise hustle culture. So the fact that I'm a self-published author is like, there might be actual irony instead of like Alanis Morissette level irony.
Right.
With the fact that I've chosen this path. But I love the community. It's fantastic. You can always find someone to help you. There's always someone who's willing to give a paragraph a read. There are plenty of people who are willing to read your book to give you a review of it. You know, advanced readers are some of the best things that you can get in touch with when it comes to being a self-published author. And my ARC team is small but dedicated. They're fantastic and they give good feedback, and finding your audience is important. So not everyone is going to like your book, but someone is, and someone, it might be their favorite book. Like my second book that introduces God, someone wrote a review and said that the second book is helping to heal their religious trauma. It's a comedy. Like, there's serious stuff in it, but like, I didn't expect that. And it touched me in like the best way. You know, so someone is going to adore what you write. You know, don't let the imposter win, and just do it. Just write, publish, get feedback. But like, make sure you're doing the things that you need to do to polish it up so that you can get feedback about your story, and not about your typos, your cover, your formatting. You know, nothing ruins a book for someone faster than it being unreadable from a format and punctuation perspective.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, those are all great.
I was going to say, yeah, wise words, an excellent wrapping up of advice. Yeah.
Yeah. And as someone who struggles with ADHD, I want to second the know your limits thing, because very true in that you will take on all of the projects at once, and then you will want to get rid of all of them because you will feel like you can't do any of them. So just like you said, I just wanted to reiterate that's something I try to do every day, you know, is make sure I'm not doing too much. I'm doing just enough to kind of stimulate my crazy mind, but not to the point that I want to give everything up. Mm-hmm. And then also, like you said, a wonderful community. And we're so glad to have you on as our second guest for Cool and Query.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for giving us your time. Looks like we don't have any questions in the chat at the moment. Sorry, scrolling to the bottom of my doc here. But yeah, just thanks again, Ben, so much for giving us your time. Congratulations on the recent releases. Yes. And I look forward to hopefully getting those read soon. I have a very long TBR, so I will try to get to them soon. But maybe I'll pick up the audiobook so that I can listen during the workday.
There you go.
It's out there. I mean, I'll reach out. I have a couple codes. I'd be happy to toss one your way if you're interested in. We're all indies, so the best thing that we can do is leave a review. One last piece of advice is the best thing you can do to support your indie author is to leave positive and constructive reviews. It doesn't mean that you can't give an honest review. You should. Right. But do your best to raise each other up, especially as other authors. It's not that we have a responsibility, because lots of people have opinions about that. We should still be honest. But if you're an author, some people will take your feedback with more weight than they would some other random reader. So just be aware that we're trying to support each other.
Right. Well, Ash, what about you? Did you have any closing thoughts before we wrap up for the night?
Nothing other than, this was excellent. Thank you for coming on. Some excellent advice. Also, some cool tools that I'd never heard of before. Always helpful when it's just Brandon and I. We try and do like a tool, kind of like, here's my weekly resource. So you've been invaluable here. And hopefully we get to see you soon with your next round of book series. So I'm excited for you.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Awesome. Thanks, everybody.
Have a good night, everybody. Night. Bye.